Welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we're going to talk about keeping your job. Whenever you have a health issue or someone dear to you in your family has a health issue, it obviously raises your tension level, and that could cause you to react differently at work. We want to try to make sure that you have a job to go back to, not only because doing work outside the home makes you feel good. It gives you a feeling of self-worth, and it benefits you in a number of very personal ways. But it also benefits you in a number of very material ways that are essential to your well-being. You have that salary income, you have the benefits, the vacation time, and the health insurance that you need in order to live well in this society. So we're going to talk today with an expert, Ed McKissick from Washington, D.C., who is an attorney who deals with disabilities and the law. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger, by Clenton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. We're getting lots of wonderful letters from all of you, and we can't acknowledge them all on the air, but they certainly are helping us to shape the programming that we're doing. So thank you very much, and please keep all those letters coming. We'll answer them individually as much as possible. We were speaking the other week with Dr. Gary Wood from Wood Associates Employee Assistance Programs, and he obviously is dealing with people who are in the workplace and wrestling with medical conditions. He drew for us a distinction amongst three terms: impairment, handicap, and disability. Let's listen again to his distinctions to help us shape our thinking about medical issues in the workplace.
Your impairment, which is physical, can become handicapping. If you get enough handicapping conditions, then you become disabled. I came up with that distinction when I was in graduate school, when I ran into an employer that failed to consider me. They had me at the top of the list, and when they learned that I was blind, they moved me down the list, and I got pissed off, and I was going to sue, but my professor talked me into writing an article. I wrote an article distinguishing between impairment, handicap, and disability. You know, the impairment is the objective fact, you know.
Yeah.
And you learn as much as you can about it. And you can reduce the handicapping condition by, you know, developing compensation techniques such as social support, you know, calling your telephone line, your phone line, or talking to other people, getting support and information, and developing a realistic approach to it. Then, if you do that, you can avoid, you know, the disabling aspects of it.
Okay, so the impairment is the objective fact. In other words, there's something that's not ideal about your situation, and everybody's a little less than ideal in some aspects. So let's say that you are blind, as in Dr. Wood's example, then the objective fact is his blindness. The handicapping is how much that might get in the way of accomplishing his job. Now, his job is primarily talking with people, working out what are options for them in their jobs, and obviously there's nothing wrong with the way he talks or thinks. So that blindness is not a handicapping condition for his work. But some employers, like the one that he mentioned, might believe that it could be. So then it's a matter of either negotiating with that employer to find out if there is a way for them to bend their expectations, or whether there is some additional way that you could change the way you might accomplish this job. But the bottom line is that the job needs to get done. And if you are qualified for the job, then you're a candidate. If you are not qualified to perform this job, then you're not a candidate for the job. And similarly, if your circumstance changes and you're in the job that you have been doing, then perhaps there's some additional way. We had a man who was a policeman who had a brain tumor which resulted in his not being able to walk. Now, a policeman who can't walk is in a difficult situation, obviously cannot accomplish the goals of the job. But what they did was to put him on the 911 line. He still had a lot of experience, a lot of expertise to share, and by working on the 911 hotline, he didn't need to be walking around to do it. So sometimes there are different jobs within the same organization where you could apply your skills and experience, but do it in a slightly different way. And it's that bending that is called accommodation, the job accommodation. And there is a network actually under the U.S. Department of Labor to assist employers and employees in working out job accommodation to make sure that you can stay employed, that's the most important thing, or be employed in a different kind of a job. And it's a win-win for the organization, because don't forget, every time an employer takes on somebody new, they spend time and money training that person. They train the person in the culture of the organization as well as in the content of the job. And if that person leaves, they have to spend money recruiting a new person and training a new person, and that can take as much as half a year. So it's expensive to recruit and train a new person. It's beneficial for the organization if they can retain their people. And frankly, if they bend, they wind up with a very loyal employee, somebody who is very willing to work with them in the same flexible way that they've been willing to work with this employee. So it's a win-win situation, both for the employer and for the employee. And that's what we're going to work on today. Our guest today is Ed Matisic. He's an attorney from the Washington, D.C. area and a leading legal authority on obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, and how the law applies to OCD. He's just published the second edition of his much acclaimed book, The Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, Reasonable Accommodation for Employees with OCD. Let me remind you, as I so often do, that while we're going to be talking about one particular condition today, let's take this as a case study, not as an examination of that particular disorder. But think how this discussion might apply to your own situation, which is, of course, going to be different. But this is, it's a very interesting example, I think, because it's very different from most physical disabilities, and yet the arguments are going to wind up being quite similar. Let's meet Ed Matisic.
Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about OCD per se?
Sure. Obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, is a recognized mental disorder. It's recognized in DSM-4. It's an anxiety-related disorder, which tends to cause people to obsess over or have obsessive thoughts that can range from having to say a prayer over and over again to about thoughts about a particular subject, or intrusive thoughts, or they might have compulsions to walk down the street, say, without, you know, stepping on the cracks in the sidewalk, or only use their right foot to enter the room, or do something. You know, OCD can take many forms. It includes people who, you know, occasionally you'll see people who have their apartments absolutely packed, say, with papers that they've saved over the years because they're afraid to throw anything out. It has many manifestations, but all of them are related to anxiety and doing something or thinking something to the extreme. It's one of the more prominent mental disabilities. The National Institutes of Health did a study, and they estimated that about 2.3% of the American population from the ages of 18 to 54 has it to an extent that they should be receiving treatment for it. So it's one of the more, it's one of the mental disabilities that has a great effect on the workplace.
Well, now there's a distinction, is there not, between having a disorder and having a disability. So
right.
What's the line between disorder and disability?
Well, I mean, there's also the, you know, the fact that it comes on a spectrum, too, you know.
Right.
Some people, you know, I go back and I check my apartment door, you know, I tap it twice when in the morning whenever I go, or once just to make sure that I locked it, even though I know I just locked it. And that's probably some manifestation of a minor OCD here, but, you know, going back and, not the disorder, but say someone going back and checking it 200 times over the course of a half hour, which is possible, that's the disorder, you know, and so it comes in a spectrum, too, and you might say that everybody has it to a certain
right.
minor extent, but there comes a point when legally it's recognized as a disability. And what I'm talking about is the definition of the disability for the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. Those are the two laws that govern people in the workplace, employees.
Mm-hmm.
And the definitions are different for, say, Social Security disability or various state-related disability issues. You really can't translate one to the other. But in the case of the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, they said if something is a disability, if it affects one of the major life activities, and they include such things as walking, talking, being able to sit at a desk for an extended period, being able to carry out certain tasks. There's a whole set of them. And when it affects someone to an extent such that it affects, when the disorder affects someone to an extent that it's having an impact on one of those major life activities, it is a recognized disability, so to speak. And to sort of just explain one thing, too, the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 and the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, they are almost precisely the same in terms of wording and what they cover. The only difference is that the Rehabilitation Act applies to state-related employers and the ADA applies specifically to private employers.
Okay, so for shorthand, we could refer just to the ADA.
For both,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, you made a distinction before. We think about being disabled as being a state for which you can get disability benefits from the state or from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hearing you make a distinction between that, which people with OCD probably would not qualify for, and workplace accommodation, which is another category of assistance.
Right. There is a big difference between the two, because, in Social Security Disability, SSDI, you're eligible for the benefits whenever you are not able to hold down a position in a national economy, when you cannot work. If someone had OCD, and many people do, have OCD to such an extent that they simply cannot work, then they may qualify for Social Security Disability. For the purposes of the ADA, disability—it's sort of almost a opposite definition, in that they have to have a disability a disorder which constitutes a disability which affects them in the workplace. But under the ADA, you have to be able to hold down a position to qualify for accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, if you're so disabled that you cannot work, you may qualify for disability payments under state or federal law, but you would not qualify for coverage under the Americans with Disabilities Act because you have to be able to hold a position.
So just to recap, in order to be eligible for Social Security disability, you have to be unable to work. In order to find protection under the Americans with Disabilities Act, you have to be able to do the job, potentially with some reasonable accommodation, which we're going to discuss next. So right after the break, we'll be back to talk more with Ed about reasonable accommodation and keeping your job. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back. We're talking with Ed Matisik of Washington, D.C., the author of Reasonable Accommodation for People with Obsessive-Compulsive Disorder, OCD.
So the first qualification for the job is that you can do the work.
Right.
Right. So you have to be able to do the work, but you may need some, as the phrase goes, reasonable accommodation, some changes, some flexibility on the part of the employer to make it possible for you to get that work done.
That's correct. You have to be able to do the work. You may not be doing it, you know, to even 20% of your capability with the disorder, with, say, OCD in this case, but you have to be able to do it to some extent. And the accommodation enables you to do the work or better do that work.
What pops into my mind is that there are two particularly famous people with OCD that come to mind, one of whom is Howie Mandel.
Right.
And Howie Mandel washes his hands approximately, 100 times a day and is very germophobic.
Right.
And one of the reasonable accommodations that were made on his show is that the guests on the show may not offer to shake hands with him.
I didn't know that. I knew he had a separate house where guests stay.
Oh, really?
Yes.
But if somebody were to shake his hand, he would feel like he needed to run off and wash his hands.
Right. The accommodation's
so that's an accommodation. And the other one is Monk. It's a fictional character, but it's probably the one that we're most familiar with now is the OCD components of Monk. And he does his job very well, but we see the people around him bending and making accommodation for his foibles.
Right, yes, exactly.
What other examples can you give us of real-life job accommodations that have been made to help people?
Oh, sure. Quite often how OCD will affect a person in the workplace is because it's ruminating on something, obsessing over something, or being compulsive to do something. A lot of it involves, say, having to do something before they leave the house, and it makes them late quite often, or slower in doing work. So for persons with OCD, the accommodation tends to involve things like adapting schedules or giving flexible schedules or making work, having a person do tasks that are not specifically tied to a certain time period, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there was a recent case here in Washington, D.C. with a woman who has OCD, works for the Department of Transportation. And her job was, among other things, to do fouling. And because of her, the nature of her OCD, I'm not sure exactly the details of it, the case never really got into it, but she was recognized she had OCD, and it caused her to slow down, and she needed distinct periods of time to concentrate on her fouling. The Department of Transportation would not give it to her, so she sued for a reasonable accommodation. And the her own therapist, as well as the therapist appointed by the Department of Transportation, came to the solution of giving her certain set time periods, which she and her bosses and her colleagues recognized where she could not be interrupted in order to do her fouling. And they permitted her to add 1 hour per day, either at the end of the day or the beginning of the day, in order to dedicate that hour to fouling. And she was given, to make up for the time, an additional hour each day, 1 day off every other week. And that was agreed upon as a reasonable accommodation.
Very good.
There was a case of a man who was employed, I remember it was a Colorado case, and he was employed with an engineering firm, if I remember. Yes, it was an engineering firm in Denver, I believe. And periods of anxiety would really provoke his OCD to such an extent that he could no longer work. Could not work for a period of some days. And he was actually did fairly well around the workplace, but he always became nervous about upcoming meetings, even if it was the most mundane meeting. And he was unsure, and it caused anxiety and increased his OCD. The employer wouldn't do anything about it. He sued, and the eventual reasonable accommodation that was granted after dealing with his therapist and therapist of the engineering firm and such as then was ordered by the court, was that he would receive a agenda prior to a meeting. And that was it. That was fine.
So that sounds like a reasonable thing
right. To
have to do.
Right. Now, to give you, sort of a reverse situation, when something was found not to be reasonable. Now, there was a nurse at a veterans hospital north of New York City, I believe in Westchester County a few years ago, who was the head nurse. And as such, she had to serve as the swing person, so to speak, on shifts. She had to get there before her scheduled shift in order to, before the scheduled shift of new nurses coming on board, in order to meet with the nurses who were on the ward prior to the shift so she could get updates on all the patients.
Mm-hmm.
Those nurses would leave, the new nurses would come in, and she would update the new nurses on patient status. So it was essential for her to be there at a certain time. She had OCD and a couple other disorders, but primarily OCD, and she would always be late. And, of course, nurses were going home, people had to stay, and stay beyond their time on the earlier shift and was causing a real problem with patient care. The Veterans Administration said, we really can't allow this to continue. It's jeopardizing patient care, so what we'll do is this. We will transfer you into a non-head nurse position, one in which there is not required for you to be there at a certain time. There's flexibility. You will no longer have the title head nurse. However, you will maintain your seniority, and you will maintain your salary. She sued, saying that was not a reasonable accommodation. The federal court in New York, however, disagreed. It said that she did not have a right to a specific position, that her not being able to show up on time, or in fact early, was jeopardizing lives, really.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore that her being offered another position with the same pay, same seniority, and the only thing that was different was, and she was allowed flexibility in coming in, the only thing that she really wanted she maintained was the title of head nurse. And they said, no, we cannot do that. I mean, it's
right.
That's unreasonable to expect that.
Right. The fact that they were able to keep her at that salary position would seem to me to be particularly good.
Right. They said that there was, the legal term was no negative employment action. She lost the title, but she didn't lose seniority, did not lose salary, did not lose benefits.
Right.
And essentially what the court was saying was you should be happy that they're not doing more when they could do when they could cut back more, so
right.
to speak.
Right.
And the loss of the title is insignificant in terms of what they're offering.
Right. Now, you've dealt with more than just OCD in disability law, is that correct?
I really don't do much in the area of physical disabilities, mostly mental disabilities.
Mental disabilities.
Correct.
But would seem that it would be optimal if these things could be worked out before they went to litigation.
Right.
Right, and is that one of the things that you're helping to achieve with your book?
Yes, absolutely. It is much, much better if you can bring it up before. And now, some people, they may not feel comfortable bringing it up with their employers, but the problem is this: if you don't bring it up when you're employed, if the employer does not know you have a disability, they are under no legal obligation to offer a reasonable accommodation. There have been times when people have essentially been called in to be fired, and then they bring it up, and that's too late. The courts have held that it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
That the employer really does have to have some notice. Now, that can be problematic for some employers because they don't want to tell someone that they have it. And the employer is under obligation to keep things as confidential as possible, but still, it can be a problem for someone. You know, do I reveal what I have or do I not?
Right.
And that's a question. That's something that unfortunately can only be answered by the person themselves. Maybe dealing more with their therapist or a social worker or something like that than a lawyer, per se.
So, employee assistance programs would seem to me a good place to
right.
start.
Yes.
Because that is a confidential sort of offshore entity that's not a part of the organization. It serves the organization, is that right?
In theory, yes, absolutely.
In theory, right. But those records are supposed to be confidential even from the employer.
They are. Supposed
right.
to be, yes.
Supposed to be.
You know, again, sometimes whether they are or not, you know, that's why you have court cases sometimes. But
right.
yes, they should be confidential. They should be kept separate and no one should know beyond the people who have to know.
All right. And then once you've conferred with the Employee Assistance Program and you decide to go forward, then you would speak with your supervisor or with personnel?
Yeah, one person who is going to have to know would be your direct supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to be responsible for maintaining the accommodation, implementing and maintaining the accommodation.
Right.
Because, you know, there's nothing in the law that says what the accommodation is. It's up to the individual situation.
You just have to work it out.
You just have to work it out. You know, it can be as simple as coming up with a meeting agenda, or it could be, you know, training other employees to deal with somebody with a particular mental disability, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be a whole range of things. But there's somebody who's going to have to be able to implement that, and that's usually going to be the direct supervisor.
Right. Now, if that direct supervisor is just being a jerk about it, then you would go to personnel?
I mean, I would. Or have one of my clients do that. Or perhaps their direct supervisor, but maybe the company may not know. Maybe the company may have a problem with the supervisor themselves. But that would be a problem that would have to be dealt with, and you may be hesitant in going over their head, but it may be necessary.
Right. And, of course, the smaller the organization, the more problematic this can be.
Exactly.
Right. The larger corporations are more likely to have had sensitivity trainings. And they're probably a lot more aware of the possibility of lawsuit. Bigger corporations tend to get sued more often anyway, right?
Right, I think so. And, you know, some very large employers might even have offices that deal with nothing but employee-related disabilities, too. I don't mean to disparage all small employers either.
No.
Some of them are very good about it,
right.
But some of them may just not be aware of what their obligations are and that they are obligated to comply with the law.
Right, and structurally, they don't have all these layers of assistance. They may not have an employee assistance program. They may not have a personnel department that's different from the owner of the organization.
Correct, yes.
So it's a thinner structure, and the dynamics in the office may be more difficult because of that.
Absolutely.
We'll be right back after the break to talk with Ed some more about how these ADA rights and responsibilities apply also to people with physical disabilities. Stick with us now. We'll be right back.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
We're back talking with Ed Matisic of Washington, D.C., an attorney who specializes in job accommodation for employees with disabilities.
Now, you deal more with mental disabilities, but even for people with physical disabilities, we run into the same kinds of things. And one woman told me, for example, that she was out having brain surgery, and when she came back, she was told that her position no longer existed. Now, what do you do in a situation like that?
Well, I mean, first of all, how long, the question is, too, how long she was gone for. And that will also come under, you know, related federal acts like the Family Medical Leave Act, too. If there was a reasonable expectation of her returning to the job and the employer was aware of it, they are legally obligated to keep the position open for her. If it was, I mean, I don't know her particular
right.
situation.
Sure.
But if there was something indicating that she would not be returning to the position and that she was not covered by, say, the Family Medical Leave Act, they may not have been obligated to keep it open for her. For her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, generally, if we were going out for treatment, be it an afternoon doctor's appointment or more an extended residential stay for treatment, the employer does have to keep the position open. I mean, they can have somebody else do the position while you're gone.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But they do have to keep it open for you. And again, I don't mean to be unclear in this area, it's just really dependent on the individual.
Sure. So, but if it's a planned absence like that, if you know that you're going to have surgery and so forth, and if you make sure that you've set things up so that the person who's going to fill in for you can pick up your job and run with it very well, then you should have an expectation that when you come back, the job will still be there for you.
Right. You have the expectation as well as the legal protection.
Are there any other things that one should do in advance to try to ensure that?
It's when everyone is saying that, you know, we will have it open for you, we're going to make this accommodation for you, a proof is when it happens.
Yeah.
You know, promises are good, and they might even be on, of course, to get everything in writing is ideal.
Right.
But, and it would be great to say to speak with the personnel office and have in writing that this position will be held open for me on such and such, and I'll be returning to it, or so-and-so is being given this accommodation, and this is how it's carried out.
Right.
It should be in writing, but not.
Right. So if you have that much sick time coming to you, for example, then that would fit within the reasonable expectation that your job would be there. So, for example, if you only have 2 weeks of sick leave coming,
yes,
and you need to be out for 3 weeks, then that sounds like a time when you need to be sure you've talked with your boss, maybe also with personnel, and get it in writing,
yep,
that there's an agreement that you can have this extra week and how you're going to make that up or whatever.
Correct. Absolutely. Because otherwise, if it's not in writing and you have a verbal promise, you might have someone new in a new position with the company who might not recognize it. You might just have someone, frankly, outright lie and say, no, that was never the case. He took off an extra week that we weren't planning for, so he wasn't here, we're firing him.
I know sometimes when people are in crisis, it can be as simple as you went skiing and broke your leg and now you're out for 3 weeks with a horrible compound fracture. But in all these disability things, some crisis occurs and we're rattled by that and we don't always do the pre-planning that we ought to.
Right.
But is there sort of a short list of things that even in a crisis, try very hard to remember to do these things to protect your job?
Number one, well, it's primarily one, to make sure that your supervisor and, if there is one, your personnel department at your employer are informed of when and the circumstances of you being out for a period of time. And secondly, if you get any, reach any agreement with your supervisor or personnel department, that agreement be in writing. I mean, it doesn't have to be some sort of contract signed by both parties. It can be a simple memo from the personnel department saying, this is our understanding.
Right, a fax or an email or something
right,
like that.
Absolutely, that's fine. But as long as you have something where they're putting in writing, committing to what they're doing for you, and you have proof of it later, that's what you really need, more than anything else.
When you get into a sticky situation, let's say that there is some litigation, does it help to have been particularly helpful to the boss to make sure that the work keeps flowing, doing things like that, or does that tend to play in it at all?
No, I suppose, you mean, in other words, if there is something pending litigation-wise, making sure you're actually doing your job and doing it to the best of your ability.
Well, let's say I broke my leg and I'm in the hospital in one of those beds with my leg in the air. Obviously, I can't be in the office doing the work, but to be in touch with the office by phone to make sure that the people who are filling in know where to find things and to keep the work going, it would seem to me that if you're accommodating yourself like that as the patient, that you're more likely to get some buy-in from the people in the office.
Right. I would think so, too. And as I mentioned earlier, there is a provision within the ADA which says you have to be able to do the job. And so if you're out like that, regardless of the type of disability you have, the fact that you're helping while you're out of the office goes to the very heart of the matter, but you are able to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
It can't hurt. Not being able to do the job is, that's a state or social security disability issue. And people in this area might worry, well, geez, if I show I can do the job, might that harm me from being classified as disabled?
Right.
If the Americans with Disabilities Act, no. If you have a disability, you qualify for the Act if, for protection under the Act, if you can show that you can do the job. If you cannot do the job, the employer has every right to terminate you immediately.
Okay. So if you start trying to block it, thinking you'll maintain your job security if nobody else knows how to do your job, that can in fact work against you.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And, you know, conversely, if your disability precludes you from doing a particular task in the job, it is not discrimination under the ADA for the employer to say, we are not hiring you because you are not able to do this.
Right.
For example, if the job you are applying for would require you to stand on your feet for 8 hours a day, and you do not have the ability to stand on your feet for 8 hours a day, you're not qualified for the job, and the employer or potential employer could say, we will not hire you because you cannot do this. For example, under most situations, if an applicant walks into an office for an interview, and during the interview, the employer would say, you know, geez, I see you're in a wheelchair, can you handle this job? And virtually all cases, that's not a legitimate question. But if it were the situation I mentioned earlier, where you have to be standing up for 8 hours a day, and they say, can you handle this job because I see you're in a wheelchair, that's actually a legitimate question at that point. And mm-hmm. the employer could say, no, we cannot hire you because you cannot stand up for 8 hours a day.
Right, or they could make the decision that sitting in your wheelchair for 8 hours a day was also acceptable.
Correct.
Depending on the nature of the work.
Right, I'm just, exactly.
Sure.
But I'm saying the hypothetical situation where
right.
it is just not possible, that it must be done
right,
standing
right,
up.
Right.
Them saying that we will not hire you because of that does not constitute job discrimination per se based on disability.
Right. Right, I was in on the creation of a job description one time, and one of the people on the committee wanted to put a clause in that you had to be able to lift a box off the floor and put it on the table that weighed at least, I don't know, 50 pounds or something. And we all looked at her and said, why? And, and is this really a job requirement? Do we really care if the person in this job can't do that? And we all decided it was not really necessary, and we took it out. So sometimes there are requirements in a job description that can be waived, and sometimes they can't be waived.
Right, and I'm glad you bring it up, because that is actually a major source of litigation, where a person with a disability would say, well, they said that this must be done, that I must do this in my job, where is that really necessary for me to do that in
right.
a job? And that is a source of where the employer says, yes, it is, and the employee says, no, it's not, I can do it some other way. And that is, again, something that should be discussed. Really, is it necessary for me to stand 8 hours a day for this job? Could I not sit in some sort of adapted chair or something? Who knows?
It's very interesting, and it means that both the individual and the employer need to be somewhat flexible and really re-examine some of these things and say, could we do it a different way? And if we can't do it a different way, then it doesn't help to get too insistent about it.
Right, right. The ADA looks at getting the job done, the stated purposes of the job.
Yeah.
And if there's something in there that's not really germane to getting that job done, they're not necessarily going to back the employer on saying, oh, geez, you have to do this as part of the job.
Right.
Because a court could even find that the employer had inserted a unnecessary responsibility to screen out people with disabilities.
So the goal is to get the job done. That's the goal of the employer, and it should be the goal of the employee. And hopefully you and your employer can work out a way for you to continue to do this job. Let's take a little break here, and we'll come back with some more good examples of job accommodation for employees with disabilities. please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now and we'll be right back. We're speaking with Ed Matysik, author of the new book, Job Accommodation for Employees with OCD.
And sometimes people do bring their prejudices to the table like that. There was a case in Massachusetts where a woman who had breast cancer came back to the job and discovered that her position was being eliminated. And the boss said, well, he felt that the men in the office would be embarrassed to be around somebody who'd had breast cancer. It was like, excuse me, get over it.
Right.
Yeah, so we do need to try to help employers get through some of their own prejudices and see that there are other options.
Right. There was I think I mentioned earlier that it can include even things like training other employees.
Mm-hmm.
There was a case of a woman who was a bakery worker who was mentally retarded, but she did an extremely good job in working in I can't remember what type of institution it was. It was a bakery in a large institution. And she was outperforming by like 25-30% non-disabled employees. And her boss, she'd worked there for like 10 years. Her boss was a former Marine Corps drill sergeant. And he did not take anything from any other employee, so to speak, and sort of was protective of her, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she was doing extremely well, loved her job. He retired after he'd been there something like 20 years, and a new boss came in and let the whole place fall apart, and other employees were not treating her properly, and she developed anxiety and could no longer work there. Essentially, the accommodation that was given was that new employees and current employees had to undergo training and in dealing with the mentally retarded. And you know, respect for what they can do.
Right. That brings up an interesting point, that sometimes the job circumstances change to the point where the person with the disability says, I just can't take this anymore, I'm just going to quit. Why don't you talk about that? Because if you quit, then you wind up with no rights, right?
And quite odd. There is something, a concept called constructive discharge, but it's very hard to prove. Generally, I mean, the Americans with Disabilities Act protects you if you were, say, fired because of your disability.
Mm-hmm.
Not if you quit over it. It protects you if you're a current employee. It protects you if you're fired because of discrimination based on disability. If you quit over it, you really do, to a large extent, lose your rights. However, there is a concept of constructive termination. And that is very difficult to prove. What you have to show is that the situation was made so difficult at work that you had absolutely no other choice than to quit. And those terms are construed very, very tightly.
So basically you would have to prove that your supervisor and or your boss just went on a campaign to get rid of you, basically. Just made it so impossible for you to work there that you had no choice but to leave.
Right, they went on the campaign, and the campaign was such that you tried to fight back and you weren't successful, too.
So you have to show that you actually tried to make the situation work out.
I can't say that's absolutely the case in all situations, but the test is that you have to show that there was absolutely no alternative to quitting. And yes, I would interpret that to say you have to show that you tried to fight back.
So if you find yourself in a situation that seems to be going bad, sounds like the first thing to do is to document everything.
Right. Document everything, who you speak with, what you discuss, solutions that have been offered, whether solutions have not been offered.
Mm-hmm.
Anything like that.
Keep all the correspondence and also notes about those circumstances
right.
as things progress. And do your best to try to work things out.
Right, exactly.
Give it your good faith effort.
Right. There are amazingly sometimes where employers are, and you know, I don't mean to bash employers here per se. There are many good ones out there who know their responsibilities and are very enthusiastic about complying with the law and maximizing their employees'
right.
abilities because it helps their bottom line.
Right, but you just gave a good example with the Marine supervisor who was excellent for her and the new supervisor who was really a disaster for her.
Right.
You know, employers are people too, and they come in all shapes and sizes, and some of them know better how to be supervisors than others. So you can always find yourself in a weird situation. And sometimes we sort of survive that supervisor.
Right.
You know, the supervisor gets fired before we do, and then that works out fine. But
right.
But in other circumstances, you know, if you feel yourself in jeopardy, step one is start to document everything and try very hard not to be contentious on the job, right?
Right. Well, I mean, there's a time for standing up for your rights versus being contentious.
Right. Assertive versus aggressive, sort
right.
of. You know, do be assertive, don't be aggressive.
Correct. Because if, you know, if things are going along and you don't mention anything or you don't stand up for yourself, you have a harder position to maintain later.
Right, right. I know in one or two circumstances in my career, I remember going in and saying to someone in personnel, you know, can we just have an off-the-record conversation just for your file?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to document this, please.
Sure.
And then that can be helpful if you get farther down the road and things are continuing to go bad, then
right.
at least you've got that point in your record documented.
Absolutely. You really do have to make sure you have a record to document it because the employer is going to have a document too.
Right.
Believe me, they're documenting as well.
Right.
Or they're documenting when, worst of all, when you're not documenting. And if that's the case, it's difficult to prove anything that you may assert.
Right. And that every teensy-tiny infraction begins to get recorded that could be used against you.
Right.
So, you know, hopefully we all have supervisors who are flexible and work with us and can make sure that the work gets done, and however it gets done, that shouldn't matter very much, but it does matter to some people.
Mm-hmm.
Like if your boss has OCD.
Right, oh yeah, absolutely.
I remember I once had a boss that if you didn't reply to her question in the format that she wanted it, it hadn't been replied to.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, you know, I learned, and I did that, but one of the people I was working with, it drove her absolutely nuts.
Mm-hmm.
She said, but I answered that question 3 times, and she keeps asking me again. I said, well, format it like this. She'll get it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it is something you... That, if the and, you know, if you're a supervisor and you have OCD or another disability and it's affecting your ability to supervise, that is something you should be able to work out with your employer as well, too.
Mm-hmm.
The accommodations there. Employers have the same problems, too, sometimes.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Ed. I appreciate you talking with us today. Any other words of wisdom that you want to impart for people? And because the people who listen to this show have medical issues, as we all do from time to time, and if a medical issue crops up, what kinds of things do you need to do to protect your job and to also make sure that the employer feels good about having you there?
Do your job, first of all. prove that you can do it. That's essential. Document what's necessary, and when necessary, stand up for yourself. There's an old, ancient, I believe it goes back to Roman times, and I can't remember what it is in Latin, though it was in law school, that we did cover it in law school, and there's an old Latin legal saying, which is, the law will not assist those who slumber upon their rights. And that's as true today as it ever was.
So know your rights.
Know your rights, and without being overly aggressive or obnoxious, stand up for them, and vigorously stand up for yourself, too.
So people who find themselves losing their vision or their hearing or something like that, make sure you go out and read that ADA law, maybe even speak with an attorney about what your legal rights are, not to necessarily be contentious, but just to know how to go about standing up for yourself.
Right.
So are there particular websites or places that people can get that kind of assistance, that coaching in the law?
There are several websites out there. There's at West Virginia University, for example, there is something called the Job Accommodation Network, which assists employers and employees in coming up with accommodations for individuals. I don't know their website address offhand.
I can put it in the program guide.
Okay, good. But it is called the Job Accommodation Network, and I think they're actually international in scope, too. But, I'd also recommend my book as well, specifically on the ADA and OCD, but it can be used for general recommendations on the Americans with Disabilities Act as well, and that's available at Amazon.com as well as www.ocdbookstore.com.
Okay.
And I can be emailed at edmatisic, that's EDMATISIK, at ocdbookstore.com.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Well,
thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Ed, for introducing us to the Americans with Disabilities Act. This is legislation whose intention is to help all American citizens have equal opportunity under the law and hopefully help you get a job and sustain a job. Of the people who write to us, there are a couple of circumstances that I wanted to just underscore. One is, things are getting difficult on the job, either because your medical situation is worsening and or because you're finding the employer is not being very flexible in your changing circumstances. Don't quit your job. I know the frustration can be high. I know that the tensions are high at home and with the medical situation, but you need to hang in there and you need to begin taking the steps that Ed has outlined here. Make sure that you understand your rights. Make sure that the work, in fact, is getting done. And if you're feeling in jeopardy, start doing, as Ed suggested here, documenting, talking with the employee assistance program, talking with personnel, talking with your supervisor. If you've been hiding your medical condition from work, and a lot of us do because we don't feel that it's important for the work people to know, and that there can be some risks associated with sharing it at work, then if you're beginning to feel in jeopardy, this is the time to really tell your supervisor what you're dealing with and try to enroll that supervisor in helping you work out a plan that will work for you and for the job. Don't hide it anymore. You've got to make sure that they're aware of it. If they're not aware that you have a disability, they're under no obligation to accommodate you. So before you get to the point where they're thinking about firing you, you need to make sure that you put this on the table and begin having constructive discussions that will hopefully resolve the situation. Be sure to pick up the program guide that goes with this show. There are some additional very valuable resources to assist you in understanding your rights under the law and taking constructive action to improve your situation. Next week, we're going to talk with a mother who worked with her doctors to save her daughter's life. It's a very wonderful story, and I hope that you'll be with me to enjoy it. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient.